Welcome to the Sabre Black Sox Scandal Centennial Symposium. My name is Jacob Pomeranke. I am the Director of Editorial Content for the Society for American Baseball Research. For those of you who are not familiar with Sabre, it is a wonderful organization of passionate and knowledgeable baseball fans. We have experts and baseball fans on basically any subject under the sun related to baseball, from the early origins of the game to the modern game and sabermetric analysis today. And a lot of us have interest in baseball that are very dedicated to one subject. And I am the chair of the Sabre Black Sox Scandal Research Committee, and I'm happy to see a lot of our committee members in the audience today, and you'll meet some of them on the stage here later to talk more about the Black Sox scandal. So we are gathered here today to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Black Sox scandal, the fixing of the 1919 World Series. This event has been called baseball's darkest hour, but we're here to shed some new light on this story of betrayal and avarice, corruption, injustice, and deception. It's a story that continues to fascinate baseball fans 100 years later, and it continues to have relevance in the 21st century and beyond, in baseball, on the baseball field and off. You know, baseball is a microcosm of everything we are as a society. It shows us at our best, and it shows us at our worst. The Black Sox scandal includes a little bit of both. I say today is a commemoration of the Black Sox scandal, not a celebration, because this is not an affair that too many people in baseball particularly care to remember. I see some of our friends from the White Sox nodding along with that. But I do want to thank everyone that is here from the White Sox and Major League Baseball for all your support all year long, because this is an event that is very important to Major League Baseball's history and to our history as a people, too. It's very important to remember our history, both the good and the bad, because the story of baseball cannot be told without the past that brought us to where we are today. You know, the year 1919 is such an important one in Chicago, and the events that happened in that year shaped the rest of the 20th century, and it still has a powerful influence on how we live and work and play today. Off the baseball field in 1919, there was massive labor unrest. There was a wave of anti-communist violence called the Red Scare. There was the end of World War I and getting back to normalcy. There was an influenza pandemic that killed 50 million people worldwide. And here in Chicago and other major American cities, there were ugly race riots instigated by white mobs against black citizens that we now know as Red Summer. And all of these events had an effect on the Black Sox scandal in baseball, too. None of these incidents happened in a vacuum. Nothing in sports ever does. Sports and politics and race relations and domestic and foreign affairs are all part of the same story, our story, and that was just as true 100 years ago as it is today. But the Black Sox scandal doesn't just offer lessons to learn about our past. It also offers valuable insight into our future. And we'll talk more today about how sports and gambling intersect. Many of you already know that sports betting was made open to legalization in America by a Supreme Court decision last summer. You know, there once was a time, Ray, when you could go to Wrigley Field and place a bet on if the next pitch was a strike or a ball, or if the next batter made a hit or an out, and it could be again very soon. That's probably not the speech you remember hearing James Earl Jones give in Field of Dreams. But what is old is new again, and always will be. And we'll hear a lot more about all of these events over the course of today's Black Sox Scandal Centennial Symposium. So before I introduce the first panel, I'd like to thank a few people whose support was so important in helping us organize today's special event. First, the Chicago History Museum. And this wonderful venue, this great room, very ornate and beautiful room in which we're going to spend all day talking baseball. Chicago History Museum has been a wonderful supporter of Sabre and all the work that we've been doing. And many of our Black Sox Scandal Committee members have been to the Chicago History Museum to do research and write articles and books. And a lot of the issues that we're going to be talking about later today come from the research that we have been able to do through the Chicago History Museum. So I want to thank Erica Johnson and Jessica Trent, our events directors at the Chicago History Museum, and Peter Alter and Julie Robluski for setting up this amazing event today. I also want to thank Rick Kuhn, Bill Lamb, Bill Felber, and Bruce Allardyce from our Sabre Black Sox Scandal Committee for all their support and for being a terrific sounding board over the years and for helping us organize this event. Likewise, from the Chicago Sabre chapter, Rich Hansen, Richard Smiley, Lorene Kennard, Bill Perch, and Jason Swartz for all your help in getting this event set up. My colleagues at the Sabre office in Phoenix, who have been very supportive in helping us this year, Scott Bush, Jeff Schotsky, Ben Rose, and especially Deb Jane for her event planning expertise. Our volunteers, Jacob Volkers, Clara Callis, and Sean Freeman, thank you outside for helping to get everybody set up. Allie O'Reilly of the Chicago White Sox, Hope Murden of the Palmer House Hilton, Mike Nola of BlackBetsy.com, and Mike Noren of Gummy Arts for those baseball cards in the back. Please feel free to take an envelope with some random 1919 White Sox original illustrated baseball cards from Mike. Sarah Wiener, for this creative, thoughtful logo design that you see everywhere. We are very happy for Sarah's work. And finally, Tracy Greer, for everything else. She is the event planner. She's been an editor, an audio technician, master packer of all the equipment that we're using today, and a lot of support, and my rock for the last 10 years and throughout this incredible year of 100th anniversary events. So thank you all for coming to the Sabre Black Sox Scandal Centennial Symposium. I hope you enjoy the show today. I hope you learned something new. And let's introduce the first panel. So first off today, we are going to talk about the legacy of the Black Sox scandal and why we all care so much 100 years later about this story. So I'd like to introduce our panel. First, Daniel Nathan is a professor of American Studies at Skidmore College. He's the author of the award-winning Saying It So, A Cultural History of the Black Sox Scandal, and the editor of Rooting for the Home Team and Baltimore Sports. He's also published essays and reviews for a variety of periodicals. He's the associate editor for the Journal of Sport History, and he is the past president of the North American Society for Sport History. So please give a round of applause to Dan. David Patricia is the author of Rothstein, The Life, Times, and Murder of the Criminal Genius Who Fixed the 1919 World Series. He is also the author of Judge and Jury, The Life and Times of Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and many other award-winning books. He's been called the undisputed champion of chronicling American presidential campaigns, and his critically acclaimed books include volumes on Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Calvin Coolidge, and John F. Kennedy. He also collaborated with Baseball Hall of Famer Ted Williams on his autobiography, Ted Williams, My Life in Picture. He was editor-in-chief of the Total Baseball Series, and he served as Sabres board president from 1993 to 1997. Please welcome David Patrus. Bill Savage is a professor of instruction in English at Northwestern University here in Chicago. He has been teaching the literature and history of the Big Fix and the Black Sox scandal at Northwestern and the Newberry Library of Chicago in his baseball literature classes for over 20 years. He wrote an essay on the literary legacy of the 1919 White Sox for a Sabre book on the 1959 Chicago White Sox. And he also wrote about the 2016 Chicago Cubs season for ESPN.com. His doctoral dissertation and other scholarship is focused on one of the writers most responsible for mythologizing the Big Fix and the Black Sox scandal, Chicago's Nelson Algren. Please welcome Bill Savage. So for this panel, we are talking about the legacy of the Black Sox scandal and why we all care 100 years later about this story so much so that all of you are here today to hear us talk about this scandal. And first, I want to go back a little bit into the past, and I'll start with you, David. Where did you first come across the story of the Black Sox scandal?
Well, being of a certain age, I remember it when it happened. And it was quite a shock to me. But seriously, I, I'm, it's I'm pretty sure it would be from Elliot Asenoff's book, because that came out in 63. I really started baseball around 1963 and started to ramp up at that time. And, you know, as an author, as a reader, you really appreciate good writing and great writing. And whatever the faults of Asenoff's Eight Men Out is, I mean, as a work of as a narrative, it is just a work of genius. And it stays in your mind. So that's really where it came from for me. And probably just from the osmosis of, you know, people were around then who knew about it, who remembered it. And I can remember going to Cooperstown in the 1960s and getting Ray Schalk's autograph. So people were around then. And then we come full circle to where you're on a train to Washington and you meet Bill Irwin, who played Eddie Collins in, you know, Eight Men Out. So it's around everywhere. But that's pretty much for me where it started, where the germ was placed.
Well, to begin with, I'd like to thank Jacob Pomrenke. He's worked real hard on this event, and of course, I want to thank Sabre and the Black Sox Scandal Research Committee, and obviously the Chicago Historical Museum for organizing and hosting this event. It's exciting and gratifying to be here, to be among so many people who are interested in the Big Fix. I also want to say that I cannot but help think about Gene Carney, who died in 2009 and who was the most passionate and relentless Black Sox scandal researcher I have ever met until I, you know, met Jacob. Gene Carney, he would have just loved this event. My interest in the Black Sox scandal can be traced to a long misplaced book of baseball history, and in some ways, some of my work over the many years about the Black Sox scandal has been trying to find that book. I don't really know what it was, because I was a small child when I read it. And at the time, the story of the Fix World Series was just an unbelievable narrative. It seemed so improbable to me that ballplayers would deliberately lose. You know, I come from a family where there's some competition, and the idea that you would lose on purpose was just hard to understand. But when I returned to the story in the early 1980s, I was disturbed by the idea that a celebrated social institution like the World Series was just so easily corrupted. So since then, though, my interest in this has changed. Unlike many of my colleagues and friends here, I'm less interested in the scandal itself, that is, in what precisely happened, some of which, I gotta say, I think is beyond our ability to know, than I am in how people have remembered and represented the event and, like so many of you, still care about something that took place so long ago.
My first encounter with the Black Sox scandal came in alleys in Rogers Park, the neighborhood I grew up in, where there were, on the far north side of Chicago, where, believe it or not, there were lots of Sox fans. You know, the myth of the north side Cubs, south side Sox has kind of been accurate. But it was something, as a Cub fan, I would use against my neighbors. Say, well, yeah, we might not have won anything, but at least we didn't throw the World Series. To which the response was inevitably, you were never good enough to throw the World Series. But then I encountered it in high school reading The Great Gatsby. Meyer Wolfshine, the man who fixed the 1919 World Series with the, you know, casual stuff of a burglar blowing a safe, so shocking, Nick Carraway. And then Nelson Algren, who I also read in high school, Chicago City on the Make, with the chapter The Silver Colored Yesterday, kind of mythologizing his boyhood experience of discovering that the Swede was out for the buck just like everybody else. And that has actually led to my doctoral dissertation. So it all sort of ties together, not entirely about the Black Sox, but the Black Sox are at the seat of everything.
Thank you, Owen. And thank you, Dan, for mentioning Gene Carney. He was the founder of the Sabre Black Sox scandal Centennial Committee and the research committee. And, you know, one of the important aspects for all of us, I think I can speak on behalf of everyone here, is that, you know, we're always standing on the shoulder of the giants who came before us in all the research that we do. And all the Eight Myths Out project that you'll learn about later today, and all the other Saber articles and books that have been written about the Black Sox scandal, we're always building on the work of others. And Gene Carney was a very important part of that. And, you know, there are a lot of great researchers that have come before us, and we're only building on what they have started. So all of the research and all of the information that we now have about the Black Sox scandal comes because of a lot of great work before us, too. So, Dan, let's get to the big question here, the big picture question. What is it about this scandal that makes it so compelling for baseball fans and otherwise 100 years later?
Just so you know, Jacob, because he's a professional, he sent us these questions in advance. And so I had time to think about it. And because I don't trust myself to go off and speak extemporaneously, I wrote down some of my response. So that's what I'm going to share with you now. And I do think this is a great question, and I think it's a really complicated matter. Looking back on it, I think it's pretty clear the Black Sox scandal was the sports crime of the 20th century. And that's saying a lot, because we've had a lot of malfeasance. But the Black Sox scandal had a large cast of characters and a narrative. As a matter of fact, I would say there isn't even a narrative. There are multiple narratives. It's so vast, it's so intricate, that you could spend years, some of you have, sleuthing each small part of the puzzle and not be satisfied with the results. Right? So for some people, the Black Sox scandal endures because they think or feel that a miscarriage of justice may have taken place, that the ballplayers were treated harshly or unfairly, and somehow, through trying to figure out who was responsible for what, that the ballplayers and their reputations might be able to be redeemed. Of course, the same goes for those people who think that Charles Comiskey's reputation has been besmirched by accusations that he was miserly and in some way caused the game fixing. The Black Sox scandal also endures, right, because of the indeterminacy of this event and the stories. It has this kind of social utility. To many of us, the Black Sox scandal seems like a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, to borrow this well-worn phrase attributed to Winston Churchill. And despite the best efforts of historians and other people, in many ways, the Black Sox scandal remains an unsolved mystery. It has stubbornly resisted verifiability and certainty. This apparently makes the scandal attractive to lots of people who want to tell stories about it. It can be put to various, sometimes conflicting uses. It can be a fable for lost innocence, as a masculine cautionary tale, as a historical reference point for all manner of contemporary crises. So in the hands of some people, the Black Sox scandal has become an occasion to consider what the fragile mortality of heroes, temptation, corruption, justice, because it's just so such a malleable cultural event. It's provided journalists and novelists and filmmakers, museum curators, and others with some sort of agenda with an episode that can be used to address their own concerns and their own anxieties. So sometimes what happens, I think, is when people are talking about the Black Sox scandal, they're really talking about something else, right? So talking about the Black Sox scandal is a way to talk about crime and punishment, myth and memory, labor, management relations, and a host of other subjects that people care about. And finally, the Black Sox scandal persists because it serves as a historical reference point and as a kind of, you know, cultural shorthand for corruption, betrayal, and disillusionment. Whenever there's a sports scandal or some other kind of scandal, someone somewhere compares it to the fixed World Series of 1919, which I think is about as elusive as it is resilient.
That's a terrific answer. Thank you, Dan. David, for many years, Eight Men Out was considered the definitive history of the scandal, but historians have been chipping away at this narrative really ever since it was published in 1963. Victor Lures wrote a book called The Great Baseball Mystery just 3 years later, in which he was chipping away at some of the narrative, the traditional story of Eight Men Out. As you were doing your research on both Arnold Rothstein and Kennesaw Mountain Landis, how difficult was it to separate fact from fiction?
The first book was on Kennesaw and Landis, and I did some of the research right here in this building. There was a... they had on microfilm the Landis scrapbooks. So I wanted to thank Mrs. Landis or whoever for doing my research for me. Because, frankly, his correspondence was a bit terse, okay? But one can always glean a lot from the daily press, and a lot of accounts were in that. But those were the days of microfilm, when you stuck your head in that accursed box and had so many dimes in your pocket that your suits were ruined for life. But nonetheless, I was able to come across a different narrative or a fuller narrative about the machinations which led to Landis's appointment, and which were preceded, of course, by everything which was going on with the National Commission and Charles Comiskey and Ben Johnson and all of those people. And that book must have succeeded fairly well because it won the Casey Award for Best Baseball Book of the Year. Then the next book I did was on Arnold Rothstein, and my idea was actually not to write a book on the World Series, even though that's in the subtitle, because I knew that was the hook that people remembered him for, okay? People didn't know him for anything else, really, but there was plenty to know. And that's when I really started to go against the grain with Elliot Azanoff, who I had met a few years earlier in the Hudson Valley when we got together with John Thorne and watched the premiere of one of those ESPN sports series shows. So he seemed like a very nice man, and certainly that was a very good book. But once you started going through it paragraph by paragraph, you realized that things just didn't make any sense. But to really unravel it further and to make some sense out of it, you had to go very far afield from the normal baseball sources, and you had to go into the New York City gambling criminal sources. And that's where things got to be useful for me or paid off. That was in a way a miracle that was able to come true, because, you know, Kennesaw Mountain Landis left his papers here. Arnold Rothstein did not leave his papers with anyone. In fact, they were destroyed, okay? If you think Warren Harding's papers were destroyed or Chester Arthur's, his were really destroyed. But there was enough there to put together the facts about him and Abe Attell. And as when Casey Stengel and Mickey Mantle appeared before Congress in the 1950s, and Stengel gave this wonderful Stengelese talk to Congress explaining the reserve clause, and then they turned to Mickey Mantle, and Mickey Mantle said, "I agree with everything Casey said." Well, I agree with everything he said, okay? And one of the things to expound on that is also it's a mystery why people love it so much is because it's a mystery, because we can't come to the end of a lot of the strands of it or to the beginning as to where this started or what was in this person's mind or what they did on this particular inning. It's not going to be solved, although in the Rothstein book, there's an organization called the Mystery Writers of America, and I found myself, much to my surprise, being nominated for their Edgar Award, okay? For Best Fact Crime Book of the Year. They have a lot of categories, okay? But yes, it's a mystery, and that's one of the reasons we are always looking into it, because the story will never come to a complete end. And also that, you know, I'm an author Books are important. They're significant. But there's nothing as significant in molding the public mind as what you see on a screen, as what you see on television or what you see on a movie screen. And the fact that two movies, not one, but two movies were essentially made about the Black Sox scandal and has put so many facts and non-facts into the public mind. I think that's one of the very big reasons why we still remember it today and why we're here today.
Absolutely. I think that's a great answer. And you know, the idea that we will never learn some of the details, some of the stories about the Black Sox scandal, you know, I think can be a little frustrating in some ways because, you know, we do want to know the truth in some ways. And the reality is there may not be an objective truth. There may not be a single through line that explains everything that happened in the Black Sox story. And so I think we may try to come up with our own narrative sometimes to, you know, understand these questions that may not even have answers. There may not be a specific answer to why the Black Sox players threw the World Series. There is no one answer. There's eight players and there's nine answers. You know, so that may be something we may never learn. But that's not going to stop us from trying to find out the answer sometimes. So, Bill, speaking of shaping the narrative, when Elliot Asenoff wrote Eight Men Out, he befriended a couple of legendary Chicago writers, James T. Farrell and Nelson Algren, and they helped him shape his narrative. And that's a big part of why the story that we most of us grew up believing about the Black Sox scandal is what it is. Can you explain a little bit about how their work helped shape what we now know and what many people still believe about the scandal?
Yeah, I think the importance of writers like Farrell and Algren, and contemporary writers too. Tony Fitzpatrick is a writer in Chicago right now who's also perpetuated some of the mythology, especially the Comiskey is cheap mythology. But basically, Farrell and Algren were both young boys when the scandal broke. Farrell, Irish Catholic immigrant background. His Irish immigrant grandmother became a huge baseball fan as a way of kind of becoming an American. Algren grew up complicated situation, but moved to the North Side, and he was 11 years old in 1920 when the scandal broke at the end of the season. So I think that is why some of the mythology gets generated. Asenoff was listening to grown men who had political agendas. They were both really leftist writers, and very much saw the ballplayers as victims of a labor injustice, rather than the earlier narrative, which was they had betrayed the game in Comiskey, and you know, America. So it was this kind of childish view that they expressed very eloquently and very powerfully, and posed questions that I think speak to both David and Dan's answers, which is putting this in a larger context. I'd love to see more research on the Black Sox, not just as a crime story, but American baseball as part of entertainment culture. John Walsh's great book, The Night Casey Was Born, about Casey at the Bat's first performance in public, really showed the links with like Broadway. Baseball was played during the day, and you went to the theater at night, and the actors were at the ball game in the afternoon, and the players were at the theater at night, and a lot of players did vaudeville. King Kelly did, for instance. But I think to wrap up quickly, the way that it's posed for both Farrell and Algren is a question of whether or not you count, whether or not you're one of us. So in The Silver Colored Yesterday, after it's exposed that young Nelson's favorite ball player, the Swede, is one of the key players in the scandal, one of his little playmates who's tormenting him says, "What kind of American are you anyhow?" And his reply is, "I didn't know." And then they call him names, and they finally call him Svenska, which is Swedish for Swede. And he then fights back and gets his ass kicked. So that kind of like childhood trauma, I think Asenoff ate it up with a spoon. And then Algren at least recycled Asenoff. You've all read Ballet for Opening Day, I assume. The version that came out in 1973 quotes Eight Men Out, even though Eight Men Out quotes Algren. So it's a sort of DNA helix of BS.
And of course, Elliot Asenoff's history, personal history himself, has something to do with that too. He was a minor league ball player himself who felt very underpaid and very poorly treated by management in professional baseball. And so, you know, I do think that when he was almost spoon-fed this storyline from the Chicago writers. It was very easy for Asimov himself to believe that this was true because it matched his own firsthand experience.
And also the whole Chicago history of crime and corruption that both Farrell and Algren helped mythologize and occasionally fought against. It's part of that story, too. It's Al Capone as much as it is Rothstein.
Absolutely, and you know, and that's something we'll talk about a little bit later today when Bill Lamb is here for the 8 Minutes Out panel later this afternoon, talking about what happened in the courtroom and his wonderful book, Black Sox in the Courtroom, destroys a lot of the old myths about, you know, this kind of Chicago corruption and the prosecutor's office, had all these trouble with the stolen confessions. All of these things are complete fiction. Even though sometimes they have grains of truth to them, the narratives that have grown up around some of these stories really aren't factual at all. Dan, you talk a lot in your book, saying it's so, about kind of the dominant narrative of this Black Sox scandal, and it's the one we talked about with 8 Men Out, you know, the underpaid players, disgruntled at management, striking back at their, miserly owner, Charles Comiskey, the Scrooge character, as we call him. And this is kind of the elephant in the room, because 8 Men Out not only is, part of our history as a book, but also in film, and also, in other films, too. It's part of pop culture, everything from The Great Gatsby to The Godfather to The Simpsons, has referenced the Black Sox scandal.
Peanuts.
So, given all of those references to the scandal in American pop culture, how hard is it to kind of overwrite this dominant narrative in the popular culture?
Well, first, I want to respond to something David said. I've never been compared to Casey Stengel before. So I was thinking, if my students knew who that was, I think they'd be amused. For a long time, almost 50 years, there was a different dominant preferred narrative associated with the Black Sox scandal. And I'd say until the publication of 8 Men Out, most people who wrote about the scandal embraced and perpetuated the idea that the Black Sox scandal was an aberrant case of a few immoral, greedy men betraying their teammates, employer, profession, and nation. These were bad apples, right? And there are, of course, multiple ways to think about the scandal, but my reading of the Black Sox scandal suggests that the earliest views of the scandal are deeply embedded in the sort of narrative building blocks that subsequent storytellers rely upon, which suggests that the earliest versions of the Black Sox scandal continue to wield power. I think, history is, like you were suggesting, Jacob, it's an inherently revisionist enterprise. We do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. And meaning is always perpetually renegotiated. But it appears that once an event has been transformed into a specific kind of news story, it's difficult, though not impossible, to imagine it differently. Dominant versions of cultural narratives appear to be endowed with a certain degree of permanence. That greedy, immoral man story hasn't gone away. As a matter of fact, I think it's making a comeback. It's still pop. I don't recall that story, the underpaid disgruntled players narrative, but I don't recall that story being told that was early on, but later there are people who embrace that narrative, and for a variety of reasons, some of which, let's be honest, are political, and I think you're right to stress that about Asimov. He saw himself as a political outsider, as a radical, and, you're right to focus on his biography there about being a ball player. He's also an educated guy. He went to Swarthmore, and he was also served in the military, but he got also blacklisted, and I can't imagine that didn't have an effect on how he understood what happened to these guys. He spoke with some of these guys, and, he was trying to make sense of the scandal, and I think you're right. It's a compelling narrative. It holds together in a lot of different ways. It's well-organized, and it's lucid. And he's trying at one point I wrote this down last night when I was going through my notes, that, at one point he says, a decent man would not betray another without some basic cause for bitterness. All right, so part of his job is to think about, well, what would be that cause of bitterness, right? That's what he's trying to think about, and that's why we end up with his narrative.
You know, it would certainly be nice to, you know, dive into the minds of the Black Sox players and figure out exactly why they threw the World Series, because that is something that I don't think we'll ever know. You know, we certainly have probably a few more pieces of information, pieces to the puzzle, because of some of the interviews that we found with the surviving players, Black Sox, Clean Sox, and even the Cincinnati Reds. But we still don't know exactly. We can't climb into their heads to figure out why they threw the World Series. And so that is something that will, you know, probably always be a missing link. To figure out exactly why they did it. So I want to get back a little bit to the first narrative, the pre-Eight Men Out version of the Black Sox scandal, which was, you know, kind of the story of corrupt players destroying, you know, nearly destroying baseball. And Judge Landis had a huge part in that. And he was also the beneficiary of the idea that he and possibly Babe Ruth saved baseball from the Black Sox. So, David, aside from making himself look good, why was it so important for Judge Landis and for baseball to keep telling that version of the story?
Baseball was kind of on the ropes with the Black Sox scandal. I mean, baseball, whether it's a Black Sox scandal, gambling scandal, steroid scandal, whatever, will come back when your team is in first place, okay? You'll forget all those things when your team is in first place, okay? And when you can argue about what trade should have been made, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, one of the things which jogged my mind what Dan was saying about Azanoff, if he was blacklisted, okay, he would be particularly interested in the Buck Weaver case, because what do you see in the blacklisting cases of the 40s and 50s in Hollywood? It's like, will I testify or not against my fellow screenwriters or actors? Mm-hmm. So with Weaver, it's like, will I testify against my fellow ballplayers? And Azanoff would be very sympathetic to something like that, and it would be very recent for him. A lot of this conference is not really getting into the minds of the ball players or Charles Comiskey. It's getting into the mind of Elliot Azanoff, okay? And then there'll be another conference. It'll be getting into the mind of me and Dan and whatever. You know, it's like, were they coming from?
Another 100 years.
This? That's right. We'll give it. You know, they'll be going through my papers. Oh, these papers were destroyed. No, they were thrown out by my wife.
But for what reason?
They take up too much space.
Like your baseball card collection. Right?
But the most, Weaver and Landis, the most important decision he makes is to ban Weaver. Absolutely. Because that's when the scandals are going to be shut down. The crooked players are not going to talk against crooked players, but the honest players might, because they don't want to turn into Buck Weaver. They don't want to be the innocent guy getting charged, you know, getting run out of the game for no good reason. Although, I find it interesting that Weaver sits in on two meetings, not just one, but two. But and Landis is has a nephew who attends the U.S. Military Academy. What does the U.S. Military Academy have? The honor code. I will not lie, cheat, steal, whatever, or tolerate anyone who does. So that's a little short take on Landis.
Thank you. And, you know, I do think the idea that Buck Weaver's punishment was almost the fulcrum of, you know, this whole scandal and this whole story and ending this culture of corruption that we had in baseball before the 1919 World Series. We'll talk later about the gambling culture in baseball before the Black Sox scandal. But, you know, it was, you know, pretty rampant. I mean, again, you could go to Wrigley Field and bet on baseball in 1919.
Or
and
2019.
And you may still be able to do that again very soon. You know, but the idea that Buck Weaver was kind of the almost the central point, because it's one thing to ban Chick Gandil for life, one of the ringleaders, or Eddie Seacott, you know, another one of the ringleaders, who was involved in the fix, who took the bribe money and all that. But it's a very different thing to ban Buck Weaver for attending meetings, for having discussions, even if he was an active participant in those discussions, which some new research has shown. We don't think there's any evidence that he did take the money. But he was still given the same punishment as the other players, despite differing degrees of guilt, right?
Oh, yeah. And Landis's very terse statement, which is both lawyerly and eloquent at the same time, about not tolerating anyone with guilty knowledge. That's really the central thing, yes.
So I want to talk a little bit more and get kind of back into the big picture here with Dan. Talking about kind of the pop culture aspects of the Black Sox scandal, you mentioned the films Field of Dreams and 8 Men Out that came out within a year of each other in the 1980s, and they have done a lot to kind of ingrain the 8 Men Out narrative into, our imagination. How these films kind of changed our understanding of the scandal from that original version of corrupt players to what I think is still today the dominant version in modern times of the, players who were served an injustice by baseball rather than the other way around.
Yeah, there's no question that Hollywood films are important, and they're sometimes really powerful cultural texts. They can affect the way, many people understand a range of subjects from the Civil War to baseball history. And it's clear that cinematic representations can bring the past alive in ways that, no offense, no book really can. And they've reached just, an incredible number of people. But I don't think we should take those kinds of films literally or be preoccupied with their many mistakes and misrepresentations. After all, they're almost never intended to be historically accurate. And even when they say they are, and besides, they kind of have our permission. When you buy a ticket, you're kind of giving a Hollywood filmmaker permission to lie to you. It's also important to remember, of course, these are commercial entities, right? And they're made to make money, which means they're usually made to be entertaining to the largest audience possible, which means that they simplify, they cut corners, they bow to storytelling rather than historical truth. In an interview with the historian Eric Foner, filmmaker John Sayles said, if historical accuracy were the thing people went to the movies for, historians would be the vice presidents of studios. Every studio would have two or three historians. Well, they don't. Back to the Black Sox scandal, I'm sure that millions, maybe even, God knows, they're old movies, hundreds of millions of people have seen 8 Men Out and Field of Dreams, and they surely have affected how some people make sense of the scandal. And in these cases, I expect that most people would be favorably receptive to the ball players as victim perspective. But then again, I gotta say, these are old films. Most of my students have not seen or even heard of them. No one in my shuttle from the airport had heard of 8 Men Out. So it's hard for me to say how influential they've been. In fact, there were several newspaper articles this past year reassessing Field of Dreams in what might be described in unflattering terms. Yes.
I say a bloodbath.
So I think these films do matter. They're really interesting. They're evocative. And I think especially, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just, my students, but I think people are kind of savvy media consumers. I want to believe that. And I think that people know the difference between like historical realities and historical truth and the kind of thing where you have ghost players coming out of the corn.
Yeah. Let's hope.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is almost hard to believe sometimes that these movies are now 30 years old.
And I can speak to the student aspect. When I started teaching my baseball lit classes at both the Newbery and Northwestern 20 plus years ago now, all of my undergrads at Northwestern would have seen Field of Dreams, 8 Men Out, League of Their Own, and Bull Durham. The last two times I taught it, none of them had seen any except the female students had seen League of Their Own. So they are old movies, and they're not on Netflix, and they're not something you binge watch anymore. Conversely, when I taught the class on the Black Sox last summer at the Newbury Library, where let's say the median age was twice or three times what it is at Northwestern, everybody had seen Eight Men Out, and that was their primary source of knowledge about the Big Fix and the scandal.
So if there's a filmmaker out there, that might be the time to make a new Black Sox movie.
Well, I mean, we are in the 100th anniversary, so yeah. Hopefully that will entice people. What do you all think the dominant narrative will be going forward, well, then? If these movies are no longer the cultural touchstones right. that they once were 20 years ago, what about going forward?
Well, I'd like to say just a couple words quickly about why I think the myths endure. And I think it's about the poetry of the writing. The most famous phrase associated with the Black Sox scandal, say it ain't so, Joe. I had a colleague who, and I won't read it all by any means or even reference it much, but a colleague who's a poet and teaches how to write rhyme and meter and everything, loved this phrase, got into the weeds of its internal rhymes, its assonance, its alliteration. It's like a command, say it ain't so, Joe, and you can chant it. So that phrase has made the myth stick, and going forward, will that phrase get revised? For those people who get a little deeper in the woods and backing up what Dan said about the change in the mythology, I think the key figure there is really Algren. Starting in the night, because writers write the stuff that other writers read before they write their stuff. So Algren's the first guy in the 1942 issue of the Southern Review to do a poem about the Black Sox, the earliest version of Ballet for Opening Day, where he quotes, say it ain't so, Joe. He loses that in the later editions. But all my students agree that the key line about Buck Weaver, because it's Shoeless Joe and Buck Weaver that are always held up as like the guys who we got to save, he died indicted. And for me, that line is so powerful because, number one, it's factually untrue, right? He had been cleared in court. He did not die indicted. He did sort of have this heart attack and die on the sidewalk in Chicago. It's a tragic enough thing. But the poetry of that, again, it's this deep rhythm and the repetition of the I sound and the D sounded, he died, indicted. It's just this really powerful phrase. And I think that's why the dominant narratives get locked in people's heads, because there's a slogan or a jingle even. But going forward, I think it's going to be revised with things like Pete Rose. Mm. I mean, could it ever happen again? It already did. With somebody who otherwise would be a first ballot Hall of Famer. So I think that the only way the dominant narrative changes is if the popular representations in movies, TV, and Peanuts. There was a betting scandal for Charlie Brown and his team. They won a game, but then they had to forfeit it because Rerun had bet a nickel that they would win. Yeah, see, this is why you got to dig into Peanuts if you want to know everything. But if the pop culture representation changes in some fundamental way, it'll be because the people who make pop culture learn the reality that researchers and historians are trying to dig into and manage to transform that into compelling stories.
I mean, if you build it, he will come. It is so powerful that they're playing a major league game in Dyersville next year.
Can I cut in here too again? I'm sorry, I hate to do this. One of the themes in my class is there's a feedback loop in all of fiction between reality and fiction. Only in baseball is there a feedback loop from fiction to reality. There are minor league teams in Iowa that have corn growing in their bullpen, so the relief pitcher comes out through the field of corn. Major league teams play the theme music from The Natural when a player hits a home run. And now they're playing an actual game. And that happened right after my class ended, which really ticks me off because it would have made my point more powerfully than anything else.
So, you know, speaking of fiction has also been the subject of you know, or the Black Sox scandal has also been the subject of many fictional works, mm-hmm. Both poetry and novels. Mm-hmm. You know, the W.P. Kinsella, of course, wrote the book Shoeless Joe, which became the movie Field of Dreams, but it was already a best-selling book before the movie and was already, you know, part of the cultural landscape. Bill, you know, what about these works of fiction mm-hmm. can teach us about this story?
Well, I think they teach us something fundamental about America and what we want to be, maybe rather than what we are. The figure of Shoeless Joe as a redemptive hero rather than a traitor is something that comes out of, again, Algren. And if you read Kinsella's stuff, he quotes Algren. I mean, like, there's word-for-word quotes taken from the Ballet for Opening Day and from The Silver Colored Yesterday. So all these writers, that's what I meant about, like, writers read what other writers write, and that produces the momentum. But both Shoeless, my students always ask, why is Shoeless Joe the main person that people talk about, and then Buck Weaver? I think with Shoeless Joe, it's the a fact that he was such a great ball player, he would have been a Hall of Famer for sure, and so he lost the most. And we always root for the underdog. Algren depicts all of the eight men out as outsiders. They're from the West or from the South or from the countryside, and they're in the big cities with slickers like Sports Sullivan and Arnold Rothstein, you know, manipulating them. And America loves to root for the underdog, right? I mean, think Huck Finn, think the Jodes, think Gatsby, right? And then with Buck Weaver, it's the person who's unfairly and unjustly, by one standard at least, excluded and punished for something he didn't do. And the consensus with my students is always, he did the right thing by not ratting out his buddies, which just astonishes me because, of course, as many events in the world remind us, perhaps it's the best if we tell the truth about things that people are doing around us.
I'm pro-whistleblower.
Yeah. And I should say, if I express any opinions here, they are mine and mine alone, and do not represent the opinions of Northwestern University, the Society for American Baseball Research, or Major League Baseball.
No, absolutely. And, you know, that raises an important point because, you know, this story is not just a baseball story.
It never is.
It never is. And you know, the Black Sox scandal does not teach us just baseball lessons. I mean, these are things that reflect on American life. And, you know, I mentioned a few of the events that happened in 1919, but, you know, as we've been talking about, the Black Sox scandal continues to have relevance in the 21st century. So what do you think the Black Sox scandal can teach us about, you know, the world in the 21st century?
Well, one fundamental difference between the 21st century and the 1919 is now everything is recorded and available and instantaneously transmitted. If these guys were meeting, if they had the technology we did, they'd have been tweeting about how badly paid they were, and we'd have evidence of it, right? And so I think that, you know, we live in a world that's very different technologically, but human beings are human beings, and there are people who are going to cheat, and there are people who are going to want to take advantages. Both the powerful and like owners of ball clubs and the weak, relatively weak, like the players or the fans.
Despite having Twitter and whatever social media platform, they could not tweet or communicate that they were underpaid today.
Right.
Because they're not underpaid today. So one of the things that's radically different, of course, are labor management relations. Just radically different. And know that these guys made good money by 1919 standards, considering their skill set and their educational backgrounds. They made good money, but it's nothing compared to the contemporary situation. So there's so much. I mean, we're talking about, this is a billion-dollar industry we're talking about now. This is big time, and so that's a fundamental right. change. They it would be hard to imagine, although I have a good imagination. Of guys being approached by gamblers to throw games. I think, I mean, we've seen it in other situations, right? The NBA referee, Tim Donahue, a couple of years.
College sports all the time.
Yeah, college, well, they're not paid.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not paid, so they're susceptible, right? And plus, also legally, we live in a very litigious society. These guys would lawyer up immediately. They wouldn't be handled in the way they were in the 1921 trial. That'd be totally different. But some of the core things, of course, are the same about ethics, about like what does it mean to do the right thing, you know? And so that's an enduring theme in this. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear that about Buck Weaver and your students because, you know, I come from a different place. I mean, frankly, we witnessed a scandal that in some ways was much more horrific, and I'm talking about the Penn State right. Jerry Sandusky serial rapist scandal. You know, and clearly one of the problems there is that people didn't do the right thing. They didn't follow through. They didn't alert the proper authorities, right? And that guy, that, you know, that maniac was roaming the hills of Happy Valley for 10 years unchecked, damaging all kinds of people because people didn't stand up and do the right thing.
Because of hero worship of the coach.
For fear of damaging the program and the university.
Right. The opposite viewpoint of whether Buck Weaver should have ratted out on his colleagues in movie terms is on the waterfront.
Right.
Okay? If anyone's watched that lately. But, you know, if the opinions were set to a generation, an older generation, with those two movies back then in the 80s, what happens now when kids see movies, when my wife sees a movie, I rarely go to the movies, is they then go to Wikipedia. And they may even go to the Sabre website and find out that, you know, based on a true story is an incredibly untrue statement. Mm-hmm. Okay? I've had Rothstein optioned four times, who's counting, for films. Azanoff's book was optioned, I was told by John Thorne, 8 or 9 times, okay? And they don't want the author to do the screenplay. But I found out that it was like I wrote a screenplay myself, and as the author, and being a Saber president, and being factually oriented, I had to change the narrative to make it into a movie. When Rothstein is finally shot, it can't be by some guy who comes out of the blue. It's got to be by a guy you know, and there's got to be a reason why he's done this, explained over and over and over again. So his character gets beefed up, and then you get the guy who, like, in the older movies would be the newspaper reporter and would be, like, the narrator informally. So you've got to change these things around a lot to make movies. Also, right now, we have, and this is not an option. Well, it is an option, but a stage version of Rothstein. So we shall see what take they have on the 1919 World Series on that, which, again, I will have no part in because authors give up. Authors give up moral rights. Authors have no real say. It's right in the contract. I've given up moral rights, which sounds sort of damning, okay, in regard to whatever this thing is going to look like. But hopefully the check will clear.
It's, as Algren's put it, it's all about the buck.
That's right.
You know, and Arnold Rothstein, of course, has his own place in pop culture as part of the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. So his legacy is continuing to evolve
right. In
pop culture as well. Before, we've got about 10 minutes left for this panel, and before we get to a little bit of Q&A, just some final thoughts here. Do we think a Black Sox scandal could ever happen again?
I think not, probably, although I would take some disagree slightly with what Dan said about the current situation. Players are paid tons of money, but owners still make 10 times the money players make.
Way more.
And, yeah, billionaires versus millionaires is what some people would call it. But the owners still continue to manipulate the system under the CBA, you know, not calling up players for a few weeks to guarantee another year of control before free agency. And that kind of thing breeds resentment. And so I don't think there'd ever be a scandal that would be about game fixing, but there could be, you know, faking injuries. If some of these rule changes go through and you got to leave a reliever in for 3 batters, a whole lot of relievers are going to have owies after they walk 2 guys. And faking injuries will become a big thing. And the legalization of gambling, there's already talk about betting kiosks at major league games. The Cubs and the White Sox both talked to the Illinois State Assembly to try to get an allowance that they would get a cut of all the bets made on their games. And you can't tell me this won't corrupt things, different than the bucket bet that me and my buddies always do about what the next pitch will be and sitting in the bleachers doing that. So if there is another scandal, it'll be about something else, but it'll still have an economic motivation and end up being turned into a moral fairy tale of some kind.
Well, I don't know if Phil Rogers is here, the reporter from Chicago, but he had an article about this a couple days ago. About could there be another Black Sox scandal? And, you know, if you're thinking rationally, then the answer is no. But people don't always think rationally. And so if you have someone who might be a gambling addict, say a first baseman who owes a bookie a couple $1 million, I could imagine someone being on the take and that being revealed. So, I mean, I would say never say never. People are flawed. And structures being what they are, I could definitely imagine another college basketball point shaving thing, no doubt about that.
Or football.
Yeah,
college football.
Yeah, I can see that. But something of this degree of complexity where you have so many players on one team in cahoots, which is a good word, by the way, cahoots, that many players right. working together is kind of, even from a fertile imagination, hard to...
With the big salaries, it seems less and less likely, but the last time I looked, Original Sin had not been repealed. And people who have been, shall we say, nouveau riche, okay, people who have come from modest backgrounds, often make very bad financial decisions. Mm-hmm. They invest in bad businesses, they give loans, they just spend money like it was water, and they might need some quick cash. Who knows? Also, here's a real nightmare scenario. We know that baseball's popularity is going down. What if the salaries don't stay at this exorbitant level forever? What if baseball salaries start to come down to earth because attendance and viewership crashes? Then we're back in where, you know, the betting might make more sense as a ratio to the salaries because the salaries will be smaller. I mean, God forbid, but who knows? We're looking into the future. We're looking into that big crystal ball.
You can't be wrong when you predict the future because it hasn't happened
yet.
No,
I can't.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, we'll take a few questions from the audience. I'll bring the mic around. Please don't shout your questions real quick.
Hi, Bob Shavel, Sox season ticket holder. What about the reports that some of the players did try to report the fixing of the World Series to Comiskey and were shut out? Did that happen? And what would be the implications?
I think you should take that question, Jake.
there are some reports, a little bit of evidence about Shoeless Joe Jackson possibly reporting the fix either before the World Series or after the World Series to either Kid Gleason or Charles Comiskey. But it's very thin evidence. It's something that Shoeless Joe only said many years later. But his story changed and the details changed, so it's very difficult to know for sure whether he told Gleason or Comiskey. But there is other evidence that Comiskey knew all about the fix before, right around the start of the 1919 World Series.
And that does fit in with the narrative of the players as victims, because, of course, there's a line in Ballet for Opening Day where it's like Chick Gandel realizing it's only wrong to tell a lie if you don't own a ballpark. So the owners can get away with the things that the players can't.
Hi. You mentioned about Weaver attending a couple meetings. What about Joe Jackson, who didn't attend any meetings?
He took the money.
Yeah, okay, but that's another discussion. But
so, like, the money is not guilt, but the meetings are guilt? The meetings make you guilty, but not the money?
Well, the thing, Bill Burns said in his deposition that Lefty Williams said he was kind of representing Joe Jackson to Chick Gandel. And he later said in a deposition with Cannon, Joe's lawyer in 23, that he didn't have Joe's permission to do that, and Joe didn't know he was doing that. And Joe took the money, but he said that he tried to take it and show it to Comiskey the next day. And that is shown in his grand jury testimony to a certain extent, because he said, they asked him, when did you last see Gandel? And he said, in Comiskey's office, October 10th, the day after the final game. And that corroborates in a way that he said he took the money from Williams on October 9th, and then on the morning of October 10th went to show it to Comiskey. And Harry Grabner's diary said Gandel was in the waiting room. So it sort of corroborates Joe went and saw, Gandel. I'm an undying Joe defender.
By the way, let me just say, I think Joe Jackson should be in the Hall of Fame. He had a lifetime ban and he's dead. He can't make any money off autographs. Same thing with Pete Rose.
Speaking of that, one of the connection between myself, Sabre, and Joe Jackson came, was it my second term? I don't know. But we got a call one day when we had the office in Cleveland, and part of Ted Williams's entourage had contacted us and said Ted Williams wanted to meet with us. And it was like, really? And our executive director said, we don't have the money in the budget for that. Damn it! If Ted Williams wants to meet with us, we're meeting with him. We are the Society for American Baseball Research. So we met with Ted Williams because by the powers vested in me, I could call the meeting for whatever location I wanted. And I wanted it in his backyard. And what he wanted to meet with us about was about putting Shoeless Joe Jackson in the Hall of Fame because Eddie Collins had told him, had compared Ted to Ted Williams and or to Joe Jackson and to Jackson's swing and batting prowess. And so eventually what happened was Ted Williams put forward a petition to baseball, to the Hall of Fame, and he was joined in that by Bob Feller, which was advocating that Jackson go into the Hall of Fame. He conceded that Jackson had taken the money, but it was the same point that Mr. Savage had just made about, well, it was a lifetime ban, and he's dead. So, and he was such a great player, put him in. And remember that what the Hall of Fame, which Ted Williams had in Florida, was the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame. Hitting trumped everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a big question, I guess. What if this was a couple years later and it was the Yankees instead of the White Sox?
Sweet.
I mean, say it ain't so, babe. Doesn't
rhyme
quite
doesn't
as well.
Rhyme.
Speaking of poetry and syllables,
it doesn't rhyme. Well, you know the what ifs. You know, there's the argument that the Cubs and the Red Sox conspired in 1918, mm-hmm. not necessarily to throw the World Series one way or the other, but just to extend it to as many games as possible. You know, this was how players made their living. Babe Ruth, the famous quote about how much he got paid that one year, more than the president. I had a better season. Right, so I don't think you can just take this scandal and put it on another team and have it mean the same thing because it wouldn't have happened.
Well,
the
what,
same way.
Yeah, what would have happened if the Giants had been the National League team? I mean, the Reds were a very strong team, which is another thing to discuss. But the Giants and Hal Chase and all the crooks that were on that team, you could have had a fix going three ways to Sunday in that series.
And the gamblers, you know,
Arnold Rothstein, it would have been a lot more convenient for him.
You know, the 1919 Giants, a lot of people don't know, had their own eight men out who were permanently banned from,
right.
from baseball. Not all for gambling offenses, but one for Grand Theft Auto.
Benny Cow.
Guy needs wheels.
So that's all the time we have today for this panel, but I want to thank David, Dan, and Bill for all their thoughts, and please give them a round
thank
of applause.
You. This is once again a pleasure to meet you. Oh, this is so important for my teacher. Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
We're going to take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll be back at 10:20 with our first presentation. So.